Our guest today is author Peter Guralnick, whose latest book, Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke, chronicles the late soul singer's life in all its complexity, from his start as a gospel singer to pop stardom. Not only was Cooke a black superstar, he had his own recording and publishing company and was deeply involved with the civil rights movement. We'll also talk with Peter Guralnick about the circumstances surrounding his death. We start off with Sam's first big hit, I'm sure you know it, You Send Me, recorded when Sam had recently left the gospel group The Soul Stirrers. Our guest Peter Guralnick will explain what musical changes Cooke had to go through after we listen.
Darling, you send me. I know you send me. Darling, you send me. Honest you do, honest you do, honest you do.
Well, Sam brought his gospel background and all of his vocal characteristics, which were so familiar from being a top gospel star for 6 years at the time that he crossed over. He brought those to a song that he had written called You Send Me. But he bleached out the sound. He very consciously bleached out the sound to reach a broader audience. It was not only that the song itself was more restrained in its... Now, Sam wrote all of his own songs, including You Send Me, but it was a song. The song was more restrained both in its structure and in the way he approached it vocally. But he also had behind him a white chorus that sounded a little bit like the Pied Piper's, and it was a chorus, rather than being made up of a male vocal quartet like the Soul Stirrers, which is what the label owner, Art Rupe, wanted to have behind him. He and his producer, Bumps Blackwell, put together a white group, mixed male and female, that sounded almost antiseptic. And the record went to number one on the pop charts. It was his first record under his own name. It went to number one on the pop charts. It sold almost 2 million copies. So clearly it was a very smart commercial calculation. But I would say that it took Sam 4 or 5 years to get back to the gospel sound, the straight-ahead gospel sound in his music, which he did when he brought out Bring It On Home to Me in 1962.
If you ever change your mind about leaving me behind, baby, bring it to me. Bring your sweet loving. Bring it on home to me.
Give us an idea, actually, how big a star Sam was at his height. Say, I don't know, would 62 be a good year?
Yeah, 62 is a good year, and I think Sam Cooke was the number two selling artist behind Elvis Presley in terms of singles at RCA. All of his hits were selling between 500,000 and probably 800,000 copies. This was at a time, 62 and 63, when he was on a draw of $25,000 or $30,000 a year from RCA, at a time when he was selling all these records. And as in so many other areas of his life, Sam was simply not content. He was a very aware person. He was somebody who ran his own business, who understood that ownership was everything in the music business, in the business part of the music business. And he felt that he was being treated with disrespect. And this is the reason why he went out when he met Alan Klein in February of 1963, and Alan said, you know, I think there's got to be something better for you than this. He bought into that completely, and within 6 months, Alan Klein had found him $130,000 in unpaid royalties without an audit, just with the threat of an audit, and he had written a new contract for Sam, which gave Sam total artistic control, which gave Tracy Limited, a company which Alan owned, but in which Sam and J.W. Alexander were also involved. It made them the manufacturers of Sam's records, and it got Sam a $450,000 advance payable over 3.5 years, and for the first time established Sam on the kind of financial footing that he believed he was entitled to, and which he certainly was entitled to, on the basis of his popularity and success.
Peter Gronick, one of the pictures one gets of Sam, and you've already actually mentioned this a bit in Dream Boogie, was of a man who sought justice in everyday life, in business, a guy who would not back down. And where did that come from? Where did that come from in his life?
I think Sam had a deeply analytic intelligence. He absorbed everything around him. He observed everything around him. When Dick Clark asked him what the secret to his success was, he said observation. And I think this was true all through life. But the example he had set for him was set by his father, the Reverend Charles Cook, Church of Christ Holiness, who essentially drummed into it. This was not a... I met Reverend Cook when he was 98 years old, and he remained a very dignified, very stern, very perspicacious man. But the lesson that he drummed into all of his children, all eight of his children, was never accept any limitations on yourself, whether imposed from outside or from within. Always strive to do your best. Whatever you do, be the best at it. If you're going to be a broom sweeper, you sweep the best broom there is. If you're going to be a tree in the school play, you be the absolute best tree there is. And I think this was a lesson that impressed itself on Sam and that he carried with him all his life. But he was a very unusual child, as his father said. I mean, he was the fifth of eight, but his father told me he was head man from an early age. His father said he was always head man. Sam went his own way from an early age.
What was his involvement with the civil rights struggle? Obviously, they did a lot of touring in the South, and he came up against Jim Crow laws and a lot of situations. Did he get involved with the struggle itself, with the leaders?
You know, I think that Clyde McFadder, another great singer, put it best, which was basically that there was no singer out there, no entertainer, who was not somehow or other enlisted in the struggle, because they were all, in a sense, soldiers on the front line. They were out in advance of the civil rights movement because they contended with the very conditions that gave rise to the movement. They were playing for mixed audiences. They felt, as Clyde McFadder said, there was not one who didn't feel the sting of Jim Crow, who didn't feel the lash of prejudice. And so Sam's own experience led him not only to observe what was going on, but to take a stand on it. His involvement took the form initially of things like refusing to play Memphis's Ellis Auditorium for a segregated audience when he was told. He and Clyde McFadder were out in 1961, with Aretha Franklin on the bill, playing her first, going out on the Chitlin' circuit for the first time. But the NAACP brought it to the attention of Clyde and Sam, who were the stars of the show, that the audience was strictly segregated, and Sam refused to go on. Both Sam and Clyde McFadder, the rest of the show, did go on. Now, this was at considerable personal risk, with threats being made to their person, to their property, and to their financial situation. But Sam was not going to back down. His father had taught him, don't ever allow anyone to disrespect you, don't ever allow anyone to play you. And it's interesting, because the next R&B act to come into Ellis was Ray Charles, who had made a similar gesture of protest in Augusta, Georgia, right around the same time. But when Ray Charles came to Memphis, he played the first integrated show at Ellis Auditorium. So this is a way in which, to some extent, there can be a direct response to action.
One of the songs we now associate most with Sam Cooke is A Change Is Gonna Come. And, Peter, I'm not really aware of any other song that he wrote that was quite like that. And what inspired it?
Well, I mean, Sam, he wrote inspirational songs. He had written a song called Keep Moving On just before he wrote A Change Is Gonna Come, which is somewhat similar in sentiment. But I think Sam would share your question about where the song came from. when he wrote it, he called J.W. Alexander, his friend, his partner, and played it for him and explained it to him in a precise fashion that, I mean, J.W. didn't need an explanation, and this had never happened before, that Sam would be so proud of a song, but also so insistent that it be understood that he would go over it with anybody. And what he said to J.W. was that, you know, it almost scared him because it had come to him in a dream. Sam was a great craftsman. I mean, even the novelty songs, Twisting the Night Away, Sam gave a good deal of thought to making those songs accessible, to making them something that could be clearly understood. But in the case of A Change Is Going to Come, the song itself just came to him whole. And in that sense, there was as he said, it frightened him. And I think part of it was that he was afraid that he might have gone beyond some parts of his audience, that he would alienate some portion of his audience, which no entertainer likes to do. But he clearly saw it as the most important song he had ever written.
Let's listen to it. This is "A Change Is Gonna Come."
It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die, 'cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. I go to the movie, somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. Then I go to my brother, I say, brother, help me please. But he winds up knocking me back down on my knees. Oh, there have been times but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
Sam Cooke's "A Change Is Going to Come," and we're talking with Peter Guralnick about Sam Cooke's life. And that song was not released during his life as a single. And how did it fare when it was released after his death?
Well, like any posthumous release, like "Dock of the Bay," it was a big hit, although it wasn't as big a hit as some of his other songs.
Mm-hmm.
But I think its significance didn't have to do with its place on the charts. I mean, it was a big hit. But it was released during his lifetime. It was released almost shortly after he recorded it on the album "Ain't That Good News," and it was almost immediately adopted as a kind of anthem by the civil rights movement. Sam donated it to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference for an album called "The Stars Salute Dr. Martin Luther King Jr." in the summer of 64, and Sam was planning to do a benefit for the SCLC in early 1965, which he didn't live to do. But I think you had asked earlier about his direct involvement in the civil rights movement. The movement at that time, and as Lloyd Price pointed out to me and many other singers from that time, they were looking for the most universally recognizable figures to represent them. So when they looked for an entertainer to appear at civil rights rallies, it would be someone like Lena Horne. It would be someone like Sammy Davis Jr. It would be someone like Harry Belafonte or Sidney Poitier, people who were far more universally recognized than any rhythm and blues singer. Sam, I think, in a sense, not just his willingness to participate in the movement, but the fact that he had arrived on a certain success level was indicated by the fact that he was asked by Dr. King to appear at a big civil rights benefit at the end of his life. The fact that his song, A Change Is Going to Come, got so much attention.
Peter, one of the things is, as you move through Dream Boogie, that guy just keeps being in your face, is that Sam was with a lot of women. Women mm-hmm. loved Sam Cooke, and it seems to be it seemed to work both ways. Was this unusual? I mean, was this unusual for an entertainer in his position?
I would say that, you know, of all the people that I've met and interviewed over the years, black and white, sacred and secular, this would have to be considered typical behavior. And I'm neither advocating it nor in any way am I judging it. It simply is the fact, these are the facts of life. And you have, whether it's B.B. King's many children, Ray Charles's many children, or Sam's many children, you have evidence of it all around. I think life on the road it's a different kind of a life. And Sam's wife, Barbara, certainly was well aware of it. And Sam and Barbara actually was one of the people who said to Sam, look, if you're going to go with other women, go with prostitutes because it's cleaner, it's cheaper, it won't create a problem, the kind of problem that going with your fans will.
Towards the end of Sam's life, you kind of document kind of a subtle dissipation that happens in his life. He seems to be drinking more. You describe him looking puffy in a TV mm-hmm. appearance. And what was going on, and how does that figure in the kind of sordid tragedy that was his demise?
I don't think it figures in his demise at all. But I think that with the death of his son Vincent in June of 1963, he felt the pain that any parent would feel at the loss of a child. He also felt a kind of guilt because his son drowned. Sam had resisted the entreaties of nearly every one of his friends to put up a fence around the pool. He also felt angry. Part of him blamed his wife Barbara for not watching the children better at that point. I mean, whether that was true or not. But I think he was this is one of the many directions he was going in. He was, from the standpoint of success, from the standpoint of opportunities opening up for him, from the standpoint of achieving so many goals that had been that he had been prevented from achieving up until that time, everything was opening up for him towards the end of his life, and he exalted in that. He gloried in that. At the same time, within his own life, I think he wasn't certain what to do about his marriage, which was he was married to his childhood sweetheart, Barbara Campbell. They had met when she was barely 13. And he was 17, and I think it was love at first sight, and I think they were probably still in love, but it was a very difficult love. And Barbara herself would tell you that there was a great deal of conflict in it, and it was not a conventional marriage. And I think Sam just wasn't sure what direction to go in that respect. And he was not someone who found it easy to express his feelings except in his music or creatively. If you didn't know about this change personally, creatively, you certainly couldn't measure it, because not only did he do some of his best work, he also was setting off in any number of new directions.
All that said, that kind of makes the randomness of his death all the more tragic. My understanding is you actually found out some things surrounding his death that at least I'd never been fully aware of, including more information about the woman he was with. Maybe you should tell people the story if they don't know the story of Sam's death.
It's really it's a pretty simple story, and I guess I would say the death of anyone at 33, whether random, whether sordid, or for any purpose at all, is a pretty tragic event. The circumstances of it don't make much difference. It's a terrible loss and a terrible waste. In Sam's case, he went to a motel with a woman named Elisa Boyer. She ran off with his clothes and his money. He took extreme exception to this, went after her. Evidently, this was her generally. She would get her client or John to take a shower, and then she would run off with the clothes and money. And I had access to the private investigator's report, which described her general, you know, mode of operation, and this was it. It's hard to know why, what the psychology of it is, but I would assume it was just that the client would be either too drunk or too embarrassed or both to go after her. Sam wasn't. He went after her. he believed she had gone into the motel manager's apartment office. The motel manager said, listen, you've got a problem, call the police. But it wouldn't open the door. Sam broke down the door, and eventually he got shot by the motel manager. What I think is far more significant than the facts of his death is the impact of his death within the black community. Sam was a figure so much more, so much greater than just another singing star, than just another rock and roll singer. If Jackie Wilson had died this way, I don't think anyone would have blinked an eye, because Jackie lived this way, and if he had died this way, he had been shot 2 years earlier. If he died this way, nobody would have been surprised. In Sam's case, he was such a shining light. He was seen as so far above this kind of behavior, as somebody who was so smooth, so urbane, so cool, so sophisticated, that this kind of thing couldn't have happened to him. And the result was that there was almost universal disbelief that these could have been the circumstances of Sam Cooke's death, both at the time within the black community, and I would say up until the present day.
Peter Goralnik, our thanks to Peter for talking with us. His book is called Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke. And thanks to Sam Cooke for all the great music as well.